Okay, so thank you for coming. And we have basically two presentations today, two votes, and then open discussion. And Jill will be the moderator. And Jill, you can advance a couple of slides now.
No, I can't. Hold on. It will not move.
Did you hit the share screen?
Yeah. Won't move like it did earlier, Charlie.
One suggestion is if you click on the screen first and then try it, it usually works.
We're going to stop sharing for a minute.
So Jill, just share it again and put it back in speed in presentation mode, and then it will advance.
There we go. One more. Okay, good. Okay, so I only have one announcement, which is that we have elections coming up. They're going to start next Monday, run for about 8 days. Okay, and the positions in question are faculty trustee. We have three candidates, university faculty committee. We have five candidates. Nominations and elections, and senator at large. So you'll get reminders. Real important to have a nice showing during the period when the polls are open. So again, that'll start on Monday. You'll get an email about that. There's a webpage that has all the candidate statements and their web pages, so you can browse through all that easily. And I'll send that to you when I send the, that'll be part of the synopsis of this meeting that you'll get in a day or two. Remember that this meeting is recorded and shortly thereafter we'll post the audio. And shortly thereafter that, there'll be the usual transcript. Okay? When you speak up, make sure as usual you mention your name and your department. Okay, Jill, I think we're ready for the next slide. And
I can't get this to work. It's working like it did the other day, or earlier today. It's not advancing for me.
Jill, why don't you leave it out of presentation mode and just short?
I'll try that.
Is the slideshow?
Yeah, I can't put it in slideshow or it won't advance it.
Okay, well, we'll just live with this then. So our first presentation is from the law school, and it's a proposal that concerns granting tenure to clinical professors. Recall that we have three professorial RTE tracks, clinical, professor of the practice and research professor. And within each of those, there are three ranks. So for example, there's assistant clinical professor, associate, and full. So to present this, we have three colleagues from the law school. And we'll start with Beth Lyon, who will introduce the others as the presentation unfolds. So Beth.
Yes, thank you very much. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Beth Lyon, the Law School's Associate Dean for Experiential Education and Clinical Program Director. And I'm co-presenting with my colleagues, Professor John Bloom, who directed the clinical program at the law school for 9 years, and Law School Dean Eduardo Peñalver. And we really thank all of you for carrying forward in these times and for the opportunity to talk with you today. So we're going to stay on this slide for just a minute with some quick background on clinical legal education. So until the late 19th century, most lawyers in the United States learn their craft through self-directed reading and training in law offices. Beginning in the late 1800s, the development of the Socratic case study methodology revolutionized legal training. And by the 1930s, most students of the law were based in university law schools. And as the traditional requirement for a law office-based training faded away, these new law schools did not pick up the task of teaching the practical skills formerly learned through a well-designed apprenticeship. Instead, they relied almost exclusively on doctrinal analysis to prepare students for practice. And it was not until the turbulent years of the 1960s that law schools began to create new programs designed to inculcate a broader range of competencies and the ideals of professional service by engaging students under faculty supervision to provide free representation to indigent people and community organizations. Next slide. So what has ensued since the 1960s inside the Legal Academy has been a slow integration of doctrinal and clinical legal education, a process that really continues to this day. The Legal Academy's primary regulators are the American Bar Association, which accredits law schools, and the state courts that license our alumni to practice. And these institutions have been pushing the integration process along by increasingly requiring law schools to strengthen both their experiential training and also their pro bono service to the community. So in 1996, the ABA mandated status protection for clinicians in the form of security of position reasonably similar to tenure. In 2012, the New York Judiciary required all bar candidates to show that they had completed 50 pro bono hours of work, which many of them carry out through their clinical training. In 2014, an influential national task force urged law schools to make clinical education more central to legal pedagogy. And in 2015, the New York Judiciary required bar candidates to demonstrate substantial experiential law school training. In 2016, the ABA followed on, requiring 6 credits of experiential coursework for completion of the JD degree. Next slide. So 2020 marks the 60th anniversary of Cornell Law School's clinical program. And for many decades, our primary clinical offering was the Legal Aid Clinic, serving local communities in areas such as family law, federal benefits, right. In the 1990s, we began what has become our largest program, the Capital Punishment Clinic and related programs. Next slide. The size of our clinical faculty and the scope of our offerings has grown a great deal just in the past 2 decades. And this academic year, we offered 12 in-house clinical courses taught by full-time faculty and 10 practicum courses or field clinics taught by adjunct faculty. This expansion has allowed us to blend local and national with international service, litigation with transactional work, civil with criminal law matters, individual cases with impact litigation and policy advocacy, and also to launch a number of interprofessional programs combining teams of law students with ILR, accounting, and medical students. Next slide. Correspondingly, the percentage of the class the clinical program serves has grown rapidly, and more than 70% of the class of 2020 will have participated in a clinic or practicum course. We're proud of the breadth of our programs, but also of the depth of our programs, and many students take more than one clinic or continue on in clinic for multiple semesters, allowing them to build professional expertise and training them as law practice mentors to new students, and often as active partners in determining our case priorities. We recently arrived at a major milestone for our program where we can guarantee a clinical opportunity to every student who wants one. And now I'm going to hand over, as we move to the next slide, the presentation to Dean Penielver.
Thanks, Beth. Thanks for starting us off. And thank you to the Faculty Senate for allowing us to make this presentation. So I'm going to talk a little bit about why I think this is important for the law school. And it really starts with the reputation of the school that, that we've enjoyed in recent years, among prospective law students for our strong track record in job placement, particularly with the largest law firms in the country. And so this has created a kind of identity for the school as a little bit of a corporate law school. And that's an identity that has attracted many students to come to Cornell, to be sure, but it's an identity that I'm trying to broaden for a number of reasons. For starters, this kind of what I would call an unbalanced identity is not in keeping with the founding vision for Cornell Law School. A.D. White said that he wanted Cornell Law School's graduates to be blessings to the nation on the bench, at the bar, and in the various public bodies. And translating that from 19th century speak into modern terminology, I think what he meant was that he wanted this law school to send our graduates off into the full range of legal endeavors, right, in private practice and the judiciary, and certainly in public service. And over our long history, we've done that, right? We've produced senators and secretaries of state, leaders of public interest, advocacy. I'm picking up some background noise. I don't know if people can mute.
Yes, you're speaking, please mute your microphone.
Forget about the
strider button. Thank you. Joe can also click mute all, but although you'll have to unmute again.
Yeah, I can't. I don't think I can do that, but if Jill could do that, yeah, that'd be great. and then I can unmute myself.
I got it.
Okay, thank you. Like I said, in our more recent history, we've kind of, you know, shared an identity with a number of other top law schools as more corporate oriented and less balanced. And so broadening our identity would be in keeping with our founding vision, and I think very much in keeping with the university's land grant mission. Second, kind of looking forward, balancing our identity positions us for success in attracting the very best law students, and that's what the current slide shows. Students are drawn to law school overwhelmingly in order to serve others and to advocate for social change. And so if we're perceived by prospective students to be a law school that does not stand for those things, then we will not be successful or as successful as we want to be in attracting those students to come to Ithaca. And then finally, for the reasons Beth spelled out in her discussion, clinical pedagogy is crucial to a well-rounded legal education. Experiential learning is increasingly important, and schools that can attract the strongest clinicians will provide a better education to their students than schools that cling to the older ways of doing things. And as an aside, that's why I created the Associate Dean for Experiential Education, with Beth inaugurating that role. For all these reasons, I've made enhancing our public service program, in which the clinics play a key role, one of the key strategic priorities for the law school over the next 5 years. And growing that program is one of the top fundraising priorities for us in the current campaign. Now, what does this have to do with clinical tenure? Next slide, please. So in the world of legal education, there's no question that the top clinical programs grant tenure to their clinicians. This slide shows the top 10 clinical programs according to the US News Survey. All but two of them confer tenure on clinical faculty. I've highlighted those, Northwestern and Michigan, with a roughly even split, as you can see, between a unitary tenure process and a clinical tenure process like the one we're proposing. Now, many of the top clinical programs are not schools that we consider to be our peer group. Right, the far right column on this slide shows the overall U.S. News rank, and we tend to consider the top 14 or so schools to be our broad peer group in the law school world. There are a number of top law schools that have managed to create relatively balanced reputations between their clinical and non-clinical programs. If you could advance to the next slide, please. And so these are the top law schools that also have top clinical programs, right? And a number of schools that seem to have been content to just sort of carry on with their strong reputation in the corporate world. But these are the law schools that have really tried to excel in both areas. And this is the group that we seek to join. And I think what this slide shows is that our peer schools with top clinical programs overwhelmingly favor clinical tenure as their approach to granting tenure to clinicians. So this is the dominant approach, right? Two schools don't grant tenure at all. Four schools grant clinical tenure, and only one has a unitary tenure status for their clinicians. And so without clinical tenure, I don't think we can compete against these schools to attract the very best clinical practitioners to Ithaca. We already labor under the challenge of attracting clinicians away from urban areas where most of the clients are and where most of nonprofit collaborators are located, to ask them to come to Ithaca for an inferior status than our primarily urban peer schools are offering, I think is nearly impossible. And in fact, we frequently have lost recruitment battles to some of our lower ranked but highly regarded clinical programs at non-peer schools, both for geographic reasons and for reasons perceived to reasons of perceived clinical faculty status. That said, even without clinical tenure, we are certainly making progress in improving our reputation in the clinical world. Our rank of 44 in this year's U.S. News survey represents a jump of nearly 20 spots as compared to last year. And I think that upward trajectory reflects our commitment and the growth of our clinical program as reflected in Beth's slides, as well as the excellence of our hiring. I think Beth herself is a primary example of that. And extensive efforts by our clinicians in publicizing the superb work they're doing. Under John Bloom's leadership as the outgoing director of our clinic, and he'll be presenting next, and now under Beth's leadership, I think we've made great strides in our clinical program, and clinical tenure is the next logical step to allow us to continue to make progress, both by signaling to the world of legal education the importance we place on clinical education at Cornell Law School, and by helping us to attract the very best clinicians to Ithaca. And John will now talk about the process that we've gone through over a period of several years to develop this proposal.
Okay, thank you. Again, my name is John Bloom. If you could have the next slide, please. As the Dean and Beth indicated, I was the director of the clinical program for 9 years. My term ended last December. In the course of serving in that capacity, I became convinced that we needed to have a clinical tenure mechanism, a mechanism for persons on the clinical faculty to get tenure for the reasons which have really already been said, and I won't repeat. But after talking about that with Eduardo and getting the green light for him, what I decided to do was to have a series of meetings with most of the faculty. So over about a 16-month period, I met with almost every member of the faculty, both on the tenure track side and on the clinical side, to discuss with them both why I thought we needed this, and number two, what it might look like. And whether a unitary track or a clinical tenure model. In the course of those meetings, what became clear was there was a consensus that we needed to have a clinical tenure option for at least some members of the clinical faculty. There was really no disagreement about that in the abstract. What people had different opinions on was whether it should be done within the existing tenure system or whether we should have a clinical tenure option. But the majority view was, and really no one was opposed to a clinical tenure option. This was really true on both sides. There were people in the clinical faculty who were nervous about, and still are nervous about, if they were going to be judged by the standard of the current tenure track, they might not make it. There were people on the tenure track side who said, I want these people to have tenure, but I think the scholarship that they do is not quite in quantity and different than what we do. So at the end of those meetings, what I did was, along with Beth, and Beth played a real guiding role in this, tried to draw up a proposal which captured the consensus of those meetings that I'd had with people. After that, that was given to the dean. The dean sent it to our APPC committee. That's a committee at the law school which looks at sort of changes to status and faculty titles within the law school. They had a series of meetings about it at which the proposal was modified and refined, but still, again, with consensus clear on the clinical tenure model. After that, it came out of committee. We had several faculty meetings. Beth and I met with the clinical faculty to discuss this and to hear any concerns they had. Mike Dorf, who is the chairperson of the APPC, he and I met with the tenure track faculty. We wanted to meet with them apart from the clinical faculty so people could sort of say whatever they wanted to about it. And again, in both of those meetings, what emerged was no one was opposed to a clinical tenure option, as is reflected in sort of the current process. So from there, it went, and there was a, we had a full meeting of all the faculty. Again, there were 22 yes votes, zero no votes, and one abstention. In light of the fact that you know, not everyone was able to be at present at that meeting, they were soliciting people who weren't able to attend votes, and so you see that that picks up an additional nine votes, again with no one opposed to this. So this went through a very long process at the law school. It was, you know, discussed and vetted in a number of ways, and we came up with what is really a consensus view on what will work. The law school is a collegial institution, and we felt that it was important to have to go forward with this initial step with something that everyone agreed upon. And everyone, you know, in the law school supports this and agrees upon it. And so that's the basis of the proposal. There might be one more slide, but I'm not sure. Right, this reflects what I just basically indicated. So thank you.
Okay, very good. So Jill, can you, if people can raise their hands and pose questions. Jill, can you see the participant list?
Yes.
Okay, so question for our colleagues. Well, in the interim, I'll ask a quick one here. Maybe you can clarify what you mean by a unitary system. I might not be clear to everybody. And I'd be real interested, Beth, as a clinical professor, how do you look at, suppose you're thinking about coming to Cornell, and why would the clinical track look more attractive than a unitary system?
The features of the contract track system currently at Cornell is that scholarship is not part of the evaluation process now, of the promotion process. So to invite someone onto the faculty onto a new tenure track that would involve sharing your scholarship with a doctrinal faculty that has not been examining clinical scholarship up to this point would be very daunting. It would be quite a leap. And I think it could actually hurt our recruitment efforts instead of supporting them.
I think to answer the technical part of your question, you know, what is the difference? I think it relates mostly to the title and then the clinical process, right? So the clinical tenure process. So it would be a sort of, rather than trying to shoehorn a different style and category of scholarship into the existing process, you create this sort of clinical tenure track, right? That signals by virtue of the different title and different explicitly different tenure considerations what the process is for moving forward. And I think that's what Beth is referring to in talking about the misgivings that faculty might have that we're trying to recruit to a new system that doesn't mark that off.
Thank you. Jill, you want to call on some people?
So Ken Berman.
Thank you, Jill. Ken Berman, computer science. I'm curious to know whether you've developed documents for the evaluation of the of promotion to tenure. You know, in College of Engineering, that was a 2 or 3 year process some time ago, and most colleges have something analogous that took a while to produce. The reasoning being that if you hire a person who will be evaluated under a certain policy, when you hire them, they should know what the criteria for the decision is going to be so that they can plan the 6 years appropriately.
So I can answer this. As part of the process of going through this, yes, we developed a standard to be used to determine promotion and tenure on the clinical side. We obviously already had one on the tenure track side, and one was developed and voted on by the faculty in the course of the process that we discussed.
And I would say that was probably the topic that occupied most of the discussion. A lot of people were interested in this, and there was a lot of refinement that happened with that standard.
We have Tracy Stokel.
Hi, this is Tracy Stokel from Department of Population Medicine up at the Vet School. So in your document on the proposal for the clinical tenure, you indicate that you are going to increase the rigor of the assessment to include scholarships. So that process is changing anyway from what I understand you're saying it currently is. So I'm unclear why that process cannot be changed towards a unitary tenure, and why that is going to be more difficult since you're already going at least partly there with this clinical tenure proposal anyway.
So, you know, Jill, could you go back to the slide 11? I think part of the answer is what it relates to. In the abstract, one could do it, right? But I think culturally, what you see, I think what this slide shows is that the elite law schools that have moved to clinical tenure have gravitated towards a dual track. Law faculty, law schools are generally kind of culturally conservative places. And that's the sort of incremental step that top law schools have taken, right? And this, I think, shows great progress in the legal academy over the last 20 years. And we'd like to join that progress. But I think out of the discussions that John Bloom described having, and I was not involved in those discussions because I was recused from the process, but there was a consensus among our faculty that reflects the consensus among elite law schools that this was the approach that they preferred. And then you add to that, and I think reflecting back in some ways an understanding of that preference, Beth Lyon's assertions about how clinical faculty would perceive a unitary tenure track. So in the abstract, you certainly do it, but I think it creates misgivings on both sides, both for the faculty who are being asked to adopt it, the doctrinal faculty, and the clinical faculty then who are being asked to come in to a system that would look very different from the system of clinical tenure at other top law schools.
Yeah, the only thing I would say in addition to that, which I think is important, you don't need to go back to it, but in the slide above this, we looked at schools, the top-ranked law schools that with their clinical programs, and you saw that there was more of a split between a unitary system and a clinical tenure system. But I think it's also important to note that many of those schools that now have unitary tenure started out with a clinical tenure model. And that was sort of the intermediate step, and people sort of became accustomed and used to it, and then it went to a unitary track. So, I think that may happen and can happen eventually. It hasn't happened at some of the other top schools, but this is sort of a first step, and it's a process which other schools have used. Beth, do you have anything else to say about that?
Just that it's a process of acculturation. When we were preparing for this presentation, I think one of the sort of grandfathers of clinical legal education from American University, which has a top program, and he described the process of starting, moving from nothing to a contract track and then moving to a clinical tenure and beginning to introduce the doctrinal faculty to the types and amounts of scholarship that his clinicians were producing. And then ultimately everyone arriving at the conclusion that they were ready for the unitary step, but it was very much a process of sort of a back and forth and a give and take about what scholarship can be.
Yeah, and I would just add, I mean, the consensus behind this proposal represents really great progress at Cornell. I mean, if this conversation were happening 10 years ago at Cornell Law School, it would look very different than it has. And that's really due to the leadership of John and Beth and the just the tremendous efforts of our clinical faculty to really to educate our doctrinal colleagues about both the importance of this to our students and to their education and the quality of the work that they represent in, for our law school. So it's an incremental step, but it's a big step for Cornell that we're proposing.
Richard Benzel has a question.
So could we go to slide 9? So this is for all law school students, I take it. I had a question about other advanced degrees, because it looks like almost half of the students perhaps are getting other advanced degrees, or just what that means. And the second question would be, once this clinical tenure proposal is adopted, do you anticipate a change in the profile of students who attend Cornell? Those are the two questions.
Great, thank you. So my understanding of this slide, this is a survey of undergraduates who are intending to go to law school. These are the columns are proportions of the students indicating what they intend to do. So it's not the case that nearly half of or anywhere near the same number of people intend to go to law school as get other advanced degrees. I think the number is more like it may be single digits who intend to go to law school. But this is saying of the populations that intend to go to law school, what drove them to go to law school, or what made them want to go to law school? And then of the populations that are pursuing other advanced degrees, what's motivating them? Right, so a much higher proportion of people who intend to go to law school are driven by public service, right? And that makes sense because when you look at government service, many of the people in government service have law degrees. Advocacy for social change is something that attracts people to law. So among the pre-law population, essentially, what is driving them? What is driving their interest in a legal education? And I think that's what this is showing. And to answer the question about who we would attract, I think it very much would have an impact. As our reputation improves in the world of clinical legal education, as our reputation as a law school becomes less imbalanced, we're able to attract students who have a passion for public service, as opposed to, I would say now disproportionately, we attract students who intend and want to go work at large law firms. And that's great, and we honor our graduates who work at large law firms. It's not that we don't want those students, but we want to attract some of these students who want to go into public service. We want them to look at us the way that they look at NYU, right? Which is as a kind of school where they will be fully supported and will be able to succeed in their quest. And it's a hard road. One of the ironies of law as a profession is that the hardest jobs to get pay the least. And so students know that coming in, and they're very sophisticated. And I have classmates from my undergraduate years who chose NYU over higher ranked law schools because of its strong reputation in public service, which is driven in part by the strength of its clinics. And so very much think that this would begin to attract different students to Cornell who otherwise would give a pass to us because they see us as much more like Penn or Chicago, a school that is really a preparation for practice on Wall Street.
We have time for one more question.
We have three things going on here. So there was a question about how many clinical faculty are there in the law school, and Beth Lyon answered that 9 clinical faculty would qualify to seek this status, though likely not all will choose to do so. Nima had a question, and then there was Risa Lieberwitz and Peter Wolsansky. So it's up to you how many questions you're going to take.
Okay, just two more then from the floor, and let's because we have to move on.
Nima?
Why don't we take the other questions, Jill? I can ask Beth and Eduardo the question later.
Okay, Risa?
Yeah, thanks. This is not really a question. It's just a comment. First, thank you to everybody who worked so hard on this. And the other thing I wanted to emphasize is the academic freedom issue, which is in the report, but I think is so important that tenure and the job security that it provides is based on the ability to exercise academic freedom with that sort of job security. And I think that's true for all faculty. But I wanted to point out particularly with regard to the kind of work that clinical faculty do, it's essential for them to have academic freedom, given the nature of the questions and the sort of responses one can get from the outside world in particular. I think that we should always keep that in mind when we're talking about expanding job security in this way. So thanks.
Thank you.
Peter, and then that's it. Is that it? Okay, so let me mention something that...
Just for someone like myself who's blissfully ignorant about what goes on in the law school, definitions of the clinical professor versus the doctrinal professor and how their tasks are differentiated within the college would have been extremely helpful. I think this presentation is great, and from what I understand from the names clinician and doctrinal and so forth, I can certainly see the logic here, and it looks great, but some definitions would have been quite helpful.
Okay.
Okay, so let me call attention to a fact. So we have a Senate committee, the Academic Freedom Professional Association of the Faculty Committee, that is charged with looking at all matters concerning tenure, and online you'll find their assessment of the proposal. So this is, again, step one. We'll at some point have a vote in the Senate, and then that's advisory. It goes to the provost and the deans for, and then to the trustees, because we're talking about bylaw changes. So I'd like to thank our three presenters very much for doing such an excellent job in communicating this to the Senate.
Thank you. Thanks for the time.
Thanks.
Okay, Jill, you want to... Okay, so here's a topic that was floated right at the new year. We then, because of the social science issue and then the pandemic, it got bumped. So what I'd like to do is just step through this proposed policy and entertain questions afterwards. Okay? Yeah, so here's the basic setting. It's sort of the collision of worlds. So suppose during a tenure review, which extends from the department all the way up to the trustee, suppose at some point an issue of misconduct arises, and we're thinking of major misconduct, and those are the three policies you see there that typically bring this about. So and an allegation can serve us in a number of ways. For example, maybe you solicit letters from grad students and something comes in through one of those, or there's a Title IX issue that comes to your attention, and so on. So the issue then is, what do you do? Okay? So at the top is in a schematic of typically how these policies work. There's an allegation, then that activates certain procedures. They play out, the candidate is found either responsible or not responsible for the misconduct. It's often not clearly quite so binary, but roughly speaking, that's how these policies and the adjudication of them plays out. Below you see the typical state, these stages that we have in the tenure process. There's department, college, university, and trustee. So the allegation can show up anywhere along that yellow chain. So here's the basic idea. And the idea is to pause the case when the allegation surfaces, okay? And you would do this for several reasons. One is to preserve the integrity of both processes, okay? That you want to stop the tenure review or pause it until the allegation, the adjudication plays out. And again, so if it plays out and the candidate is not responsible, you simply resume from the pause point without reference to the allegations. Okay. On the other hand, if the candidate is responsible for some part of the case, then the review restarts with a misconduct summary in the dossier. So let me explain a little bit about what that means and how the pause would be triggered. So one notion here is we'll just call it the pause panel. So the pause panel consists of four people: the candidate's chair, the candidate's dean, the provost, and the dean of faculty. And they have to look at and make a decision about whether or not the case should be delayed or paused. Now notice, delayed means that the allegations surface before the process begins and so on. So the pause panel, if they decide to pause the case, will then produce a, and if there's if the candidate is found to be responsible for the misconduct, they'll prepare a privacy-respecting misconduct summary that goes into the dossier. Now again, if this is the case, the thing is recycled. You start from scratch, or you start back at the beginning and sort of redo the case and from that point. But let's go to the next slide to clarify that. So, I guess this is just, again, a definition. So the red line determines whether we're talking about a delay or a pause. So that's a pretty standard definition. Here is another schematic. So the allegation comes in and the panel decides, based on that information, whether it's significant enough to warrant a pause. All along the way here, and in particular at this point, the candidate has the right to respond and to put documents into the dossier that become part of the official record. So again, it's at that point when one of the procedures is triggered because of an allegation that the pause panel will then review that allegation and make a decision about the pause. And then after it plays out, the panel produces or gets the final report and then writes a privacy-respecting summary that is added to the dossier. Okay? So let's look at the two scenarios again. Suppose it's the found not responsible scenario. The review simply picks up where it left off. No reference to the allegation should show up in the remainder of the review unless the candidate gives permission. The candidate might want to include a statement about it to perhaps talk about the situation, how it came about, misunderstandings and so on. So the candidate does have the right to insert a document into the dossier that will be seen downstream from the pause point by those who are reviewing the case. Next.
You want the next one?
Yep. Okay, so here's an example of a found responsible thing. And let's just, for the sake of example, that the pause point was at the college level. So maybe something came up in an ad hoc committee review or something like that. So it's pause, and it turns out, let's say, that the candidate is responsible for some type of misconduct. Now, when we say restart, it doesn't mean from ground zero. It goes back to the department. The department is not going to redo the external letters or whatever. It's simply going to revisit the case with this added piece of information. Okay? So again, it's not revisit does not mean start from scratch. Let's see. Yeah, so again, the rationale for restarting is that evaluators at the department, college, and university levels must see the same dossier. That's sort of an axiom in the tenure business, right? You talk about closing the case at a certain date. The candidate no longer adds recent papers or whatever. The key principle that we have in the tenure review process is that at every stage, you're looking at the same set of credentials, the same the dossier is the same at each level. So that's sort of a consistent with how we do things without any kind of misconduct as in part of the scene. Okay? So the question here is, so online you can see the formal policy. It's like a two-pager. It would go into the faculty handbook section on tenure. But here are the things for the Senate and the faculty in general to think about when they reason about the strategy here. So one question here is, what makes an allegation serious enough to warrant a pause? It's quite hard to carve that into precise language, but that's a very important thing. How do we reason about, how does the pause panel make its decision to do a pause? Then there's an extremely important issue about how well the policy deals with confidentiality. This gets at the idea of the pause panel producing a summary report, and how can you, how do you do that in a way that respects the rules we have about confidentiality and privacy? Then there's the issue about how does this the pause affect the tenure track, the voters? Okay, how will it affect the candidate's reputation? Does it square with the idea of innocent until proven guilty? These are all the kinds of things that we want the faculty in the Senate to think about in advance of deciding whether the recommended policy here is appropriate and good. So I should say that the policy was produced through the Academic Freedom Professional Status of the ASPSF Committee. This one has the worst title. Anyway, their job, as we saw in the law discussion, is to deal with all matters concerning tenure. So that document was worked out in the committee with consultation with John Silicano and University Council and so on. Just a reminder, no one entity owns the tenure policy. It's a shared enterprise. The provost office, the faculty, are all, and human resources, all have something to say about the tenure policy. So the idea here then is for the faculty to decide that this is the right way to go about this very serious problem that happens not much, but when it does happen, these are really tough cases. I think I talked to Madeline, and I think maybe one or two a year show up, and we really have no policy for handling this. So the idea here then is to have some guidelines to handle perhaps the most difficult kind of issue associated with, one of the most difficult settings to deal with. We have no policy and we need one. So that's it. And love to take some questions so that we can, if necessary, go back and make some refinements. Online, there were several comments posted, again, about 2 months ago. They're interesting. Some people say there should be no intersection of the policies, that tenure is not about these sorts of things, and it should proceed independently. And if the case, there's no need to pause. If the person is found guilty and they were just granted tenure, you can still prosecute. So you see that kind of an argument. You see arguments about fairness to the candidate, right? That a pause, you may say, well, it's a stain. You know, if your case is paused, you must have done something bad. But the pause actually, if you look at it the right way, it promotes fairness and deals with rumors in an effective sort of way. Anyway, I've talked too much. I'd be very interested in hearing from you your reactions to this policy.
Ken Berman.
Thank you, Charlie. And you never talk too much. And that was a very good presentation. I support what you're trying to do here, but I do have one concern. We've heard allegations, in my case, actually heard directly that under the consensual relations policy, a great deal of harassment of people is occurring, that we're getting large numbers of sort of fake harassment allegations, which have to be cleared by Mary Opperman's office, and a low percentage of legitimate complaints. I'm concerned that if that carries over to this policy, then an aggrieved ex-partner can pause someone's tenure, possibly for quite a while. So I'd like to know how the pause committee would sort out legitimate from harassment complaints.
That's right. So that's one of the key decision points in this process. I don't have a snap answer for that, but that obviously would have to be taken into consideration. So I don't know how you could, there's no formula that can sort of say, well, this is a spurious allegation or not, but it's clearly something that you'd have to pay attention to in that venue. So a very good point.
There's a question, who decides whether the candidate is guilty or innocent?
That would sit within the, whatever, you know, if it was a research misconduct case, there's a whole adjudication process under policy 1.2, that's where that decision would be made. Ditto under 6.3 and 6.4, they're procedures that are followed and they're the ones that determine whether or not the allegation had merit or not and what the sanction would be.
Richard Benzel.
So here's a concern. Under 6.4 and many of these adjudications in the OJA's office, there are often substantial delays. And the delays come from the complaint coming from the outside the university, somebody who's graduated or somebody who's left the university. They can't be easily found or not found, but easily be heard in the process. So is there any, the concern is that this pause could go on for a long, long time. And that would make that affects the candidate's reputation, that affects their career. And so forth and so on. So the question really, it's not a question, it's a comment about how really limit the impact of these kinds of pauses so that the process doesn't inordinately affect the candidate's career.
That's right. So even if all the players are on campus, I can tell you for a fact, these things play out, they just take an incredibly long time. So that is a concern. I raised the point about whether you could accelerate the process in these sorts of cases. And you might think so, but there'd be no guarantees about that. These things do take time. As I said, this is a really hard problem, right? You have to have due process. You have to do things in an appropriate way. And unfortunately, they do take time. So I get back to this sort of issue. Right now, there's no policy, right? If someone can think of a way to address the length of time that these adjudication processes take, it'd be great to incorporate them. But again, I don't see any way of shortcutting that at this point.
I have two questions, Risa Lieberwitz and Wendy Wilcox next.
Okay.
Do you want me to go first? I can defer to Wendy first if she wants to go. I don't care.
Go ahead.
Okay. I have many of the same concerns that other people have raised. And I'm very pulled towards the point that Charlie, you raised, that somebody, at least one person had posted on the Dean of Faculty website, of looking at these as separate issues, that you handle the tenure review process and you can also handle allegations separately. The fact that there's a coincidence of time is, you know, is what we're trying to deal with, but you can always have allegations come up early in somebody's career on the tenure track or later. They can always come up and they will always be dealt with separately at those times. So considering a pause at this point is simply because of the coincidence in time. I would really, at this point, favor keeping these as separate processes, because I think that the pause panel will be very heavily weighted towards finding that there should be a pause. If in doubt, it'll probably go towards a pause. I think that that really harms a candidate. I think the prejudicial effect of the pause itself is so harmful that it will be very difficult for a candidate to actually be freed from that. And then the time issue that Richard just talked about. I think that this is fraught with problems to have this pause, and I would really favor, as I said, at this point, unless something convinces me differently, at this point I really favor just looking at these as separate issues, and they should be dealt with separately.
What if it's research misconduct, and suppose the candidate had this brilliant paper that ended up being plagiarized, but the case went through? How would you feel about that?
Well, I think that, again, that can come up at any time. And you know, there are certainly examples that it has come up at any time in somebody's career. And perhaps, you know, it's something that just simply takes time to surface. But the fact that it's a coincidence seems to me not to be a time, not to be a reason to merge the two. I think the prejudicial impact is so great that the merger is not, it's certainly not the only way to do it, to merge the two issues and have this kind of pause. There are alternatives that will not have that kind of prejudicial impact. And if in fact something is serious enough to warrant some kind of a misconduct sanction, that can be done at any moment.
What about rumors that turned the department against the candidate, which ended up being false?
What about it?
Suppose there are rumors about a misconduct, and that the case isn't paused. But the department sort of hears about it, and it really colors people's thinking of the candidate to the point of perhaps creating a negative vote.
It seems to me what could be done is that a candidate could be given the option to pause a review, that you wouldn't have to have it imposed on a candidate, because what you're raising is something that would hurt the candidate. So if there's some opportunity for a candidate to pause a review, then, you know, that can be built in. I don't think we need this huge mechanism to be put into place in order to give somebody a chance to say, well, there's a lot of rumors and I'd rather have a pause now.
Okay, thank you. Wendy.
Thanks. Wendy Wilcox from the library. Obviously, we don't have quite the same tenure process in the library, but I do have some significant concerns with some of the issues that have been raised. I think they actually very unfairly affect typically minority voices, whether they're graduate students, whether they are women, whether they are people of color. Often some of these issues that tend to arise during the tenure process are because that is the moment under which confidentiality is guaranteed. And so we have to really understand that when this is happening at the same time, there's probably a reason why they're happening. And I understand some kind of concerns about harassment or spurious claims, but I think that that is a historical argument in favor of keeping status quo and protecting accusers often, or protecting the violators. And I would think that we are confident enough in our processes to pause and ensure that we are getting all the information before we offer possible faculty lifetime appointments to our university when it's way more difficult and way more problematic to address these issues once someone has gotten tenure. And I did notice that Chris Schaefer posted a comment that says that he could not fairly evaluate someone without within kind of in the air process. And so I understand the concerns about protecting faculty, but I also think that we have to think about all the mechanisms in place and not just the implications on tenure track faculty.
Okay, thanks, Wendy. Paul Ginsmark?
Yeah, I just wanted to bring up a case that we had in physics, which I'm not violating any confidences because it's public and it's also in the Chronicle for Higher Ed and the Daily Sun. But I think it represents the flip side of something that Charlie said, and that's also come up. And in that case, we were asked to decide on tenure when there was actually an ongoing investigation going on, but, and it involved not research questions, but a sexual harassment issue, actually even worse, questionable whether it was a consensual relationship. The faculty at large was not informed because the idea of the chair who consulted with the higher ups is that this should not affect the tenure process at all. And the faculty went ahead and voted in favor of the tenure. And the faculty looked absolutely awful from the standpoint of the graduate students, because among all of the graduate students who assumed that this was common knowledge among the faculty, it was common knowledge among the graduate students. Most of us were entirely ignorant. So, this puts another twist on it, arguing in favor of a pause, just so that the faculty doesn't end up looking embarrassed. As a footnote to this particular case, it was turned down by the Arts and Sciences Dean, who apparently was aware of some of the issues, and it went to litigation and various other things. But, again, I would say this also favors a pause.
Thanks. How about Chris Schaefer, then Carl, then Peter? Chris. Chris Schaefer?
Okay,
Carl?
Sorry. Oh. I'm here. Sorry, Charlie. I just wanted to say to Reese's point, I just can't imagine moving forward in good conscience with a vote on someone where there were substantial unresolved issues that directly bore on their conduct and their ability to be a successful faculty member. I don't know what it is I'm supposed to do as a conscientious faculty member. I'm supposed to pretend I don't know about it. Is that information supposed to be withheld from me? What if I do hear about it? I'm supposed to ignore it. Like, it just puts those of us that are making one of the biggest decisions we make to award tenure in this impossible bind. And we're doing it because why? We're afraid of making a principled pause in the process of a few months to a fraction of a year. Agreed. It could be unfortunately long. But in cases where the faculty member is not responsible for these accusations, many folks are going to still hear about it. It's still going to influence their vote. I would think it's to the benefit of the faculty member for the issue to be resolved before these things move forward.
Thanks. Carl?
Thanks a lot. I appreciate this. It's given me a chance to think hard about it. I'm Carl Frank from physics. So I feel like having served on a jury, you have to be able to follow instructions and disregard information. I think that's our job. And also I would say that if you're in a situation where there's allegations, it's very good to assume that until something is proven, that those allegations shouldn't enter into your deliberations. I do feel at the same time that I think our colleagues from the library said we have to enforce our rules about consensual behavior and non-consensual behavior. I think that we have to absolutely protect that. But I think that the fact from one experience, it takes a long time to smoke out the facts. And just a comment, in my own personal experience, I think there are still consequences of things that happen that will go off forever, you know, for long, long periods of time. So I'm very much in favor of not adopting the pause thing, because I think in any case where it really matters, it's just going to pause forever. And I think that the question of the perception of our students and things like that, well, there are lots of things that happen that students don't understand and other faculty don't understand. Why does Professor X leave from Cornell to go to another university? We don't know. Why did Lehman leave? We still don't know, you know, that kind of stuff. So I don't think this is a good idea. I like the idea that Risa said, and I think she said it very clearly, that we have to be able to separate these things. And people should just notice that after a while, so-and-so is no longer here and justice got served. So I'm against the proposition.
Peter.
I think the pause is very important. And I think this policy that you've drafted here, Charlie, is extremely important. We just had a recent case in chemistry and chemical biology and of academic malfeasance that questioning some results on the part of a person coming up for tenure. And it was through a graduate student that this was learned. And it was only through the tenure process where we asked for comments by the graduate students under the tutelage of the professor that we learned of the malfeasance. And then the administration tried to force us to go through with the tenure decision. The chair was very adamant in not touching the tenure decision until some sort of investigation occurred. And apparently, and again, I don't know exactly what happened, but outside parties were involved. It was discovered that there was significant problems in the data that was supposedly brought forth in a few papers by this person, and it saved the department a tremendous amount of time. And without a pause, I'm afraid, I don't know how you retract a tenure decision, but that might have been the case, and that would have brought a god-awful mess into the whole thing. So a lot of these problems, you know, in science, they don't show up until you start asking for the letters and asking for students' opinions about somebody. And that's when the students have a chance to actually put on record what the problems actually exist.
Okay, last comment, Risa, briefly.
Okay, I just wanted to mention, actually, when Wendy was speaking, I thought she was going to go a different direction in terms of faculty who are in underrepresented groups, because my concern is that often the people who are the most vulnerable to allegations are the faculty from underrepresented groups. There's a real double standard. It's oftentimes applied to faculty, women, people of color generally. And I get very concerned. I mean, that's a concern whether we have this pause or not. But I think that this kind of policy is one where the allegations that are raised will also raise that kind of double standard of bringing to the fore and making even more salient allegations against people who are more vulnerable to being held to different standards.
Okay, thank you very much. So lots of good suggestions here. We'll take them into consideration and come back with something. Okay, we're running behind here. Let's see if we can handle these two votes expeditiously. I don't think, let's see, Jill?
Yeah.
Okay, so let's see. So we have to do some semblance of Robert's rules here. So the two resolutions I'd like to process here, one of them concerns the professor of the practice authorization for the vet school. I need someone to offer a motion to consider this.
There's a motion.
Okay, here it is. And Alex Travis from the Vet School is on tap in case there are any questions. As usual, we post these requests for 60 days. There were no voice concerns. The Vet School would like to be able to use this title to recruit and retain outstanding faculty and so on. And it joins many other colleges that have this title. Does anyone want to discuss this or any questions for Alex? Okay, let's, next slide. Did someone call for a vote? Do we have a motion to vote on the resolution? Somebody.
I move that we vote on the resolution.
Okay, yeah. Okay, so one of the problems we have in doing votes online is that the audience, they're non-senators amongst us and so on. So the easy way to do this is simply for you at this point just to go on chat and just say yes or no, and we can then deduce everything from the log. Okay?
Oh, wow.
Okay, so, I'm quite sure we have quorum today. We'll make sure that at least 65 people voted. That's quorum. Okay? Next slide, Jill.
Oh, sorry.
Excuse me, can I just ask, you want us to just post on chat to everyone yes or no, or do you want it just to come to one of you, or what?
Everyone, please. Oh.
Good. Just post yes or no. That's all you have to do. Okay, this...
We have to
talk about this, and then we'll close the current voting and open up the second round. So this is something we brought up in the March meeting. It happens, but rarely, that a student takes a course from a family member. And there's an obvious conflict of interest, and it was felt that we should have a line or two in the conflict of interest policy 4.14 that deals with this. Do we have a motion to consider this resolution?
I move that we consider it.
There's a motion.
Okay, move it on. Next slide.
Sorry.
Next slide, please. So here's what we had in March, and then there was a little bit of a dust-up afterwards. So it was pretty, quite a few hurdles were put in there, that the course had to be an elective, or you had to do an SU or whatever, and people sort of felt it was just too restrictive. Just to simply stick with a recusal plan and get on with it. So we revised, so working with others, in particular the individuals who at the March meeting felt we should just live with the last line, we modified the proposal, Jill? Okay, it simply says basically recusal plan, and then that has to be signed by the student, the instructor, and the chair, and a little bit about the recusal plan. It simply has to map out a way, the grading process, in a way that doesn't involve the instructor. And the has to also be fair to how with respect to the other students. So again, anyone want to comment on this or feel it's heavy-handed or whatever? Seeing none, let's someone want to call for a vote?
Moved.
Okay, we do the same thing now, and it's simply yes, no, or abstain. Okay, we have 15 minutes, but we could go. I'm happy to stay longer. Open discussion about current events, okay, namely the pandemic and how it's affecting life at the university. Happy to hear about anything. I'll just name a couple of topics in case you want to bring them up. How do you feel about messaging from the central administration, from your college, from your department? Do you feel it's working? Have you had feedback? Many of you are teaching, of course, and you've heard things from your colleagues. What's the feedback on the grade option discussion we had a while ago? What are the vibes you're picking up from your students? And so on. So virtually anything, open discussion. There's increasing attention is being paid to the fall. Let me just sort of just begin with this, say a little bit about that. Now that we're sort of in steady state in the online portion of S20, what about F20? So, of course, everything is in a state of flux, okay? The decision will be made as late as possible, but it can't be the night before. It can't be in August. So you can imagine all the constraints involved, what Governor Cuomo has to say. What's the state of testing? Is it, do we have fast, reliable, quick testing? I think in terms of unwinding all the lockdowns, you have to sort of take pity on the universities because, quite honestly, I can't see a university opening up unless an NBA game is authorized for Madison Square Garden. I mean, I think it has to be at that level. So, it's a real tricky thing, and Ithaca is even has a higher degree of difficulty because we have a basic population of 30,000, then in come 20,000 students. So you can appreciate the complexity of that. Everyone's working on contingency plans, but there's nothing, I don't think we can expect anything definite for, until we get at least into June. Anyway, that little preamble, I'm happy to, I doubt if I can answer questions, but I can pass them along. Anything that's on your mind, anything you'd like to talk about. Jill, what do you say? So
we have one question on chat. I'm being asked by students if the fall semester will take place on campus. And we have people waiting, Carl Frank, Ken Berman.
But it's going to be a while before we know the answer to what the fall looks like. One thing that is pretty clear, though, is it's highly likely that the whole international student scene is going to be severely disrupted. You need sort of 2 months to get a visa. Consulates are closed. So we're talking about like June 20. So that is almost assuredly going to be an issue in the fall.
Carl Frank.
Thank you, Carl Frank, Physics. First off, just personally, I really appreciate the tremendous amount of support we've gotten in preparing for teaching. About the SU option, I haven't heard any complaints from my students, and so I think we've made a good decision with that one. What I would like to bring, and now I'm speaking for the physics department, we think the provost, first off, on Monday we had a Zoom colloquium, which was well attended, so we know how to conserve funds. But we're really concerned about going into next fall and being the kind of organization which we feel that our colloquia don't just serve ourselves, but other departments as well. So we, to quote our feelings, the provost's rules on finances are draconian, and we hope there'll be some loosening up that will allow us to start a program which serves the whole university, such as the various colloquia.
Okay, thanks. Joe?
Ken Berman?
Briefly, I think that there's a group not well represented in the Senate of young researchers who need physical access to equipment or laboratories who are very harmed right now because whereas many of us can teach from home, do our writing from home, this group is completely dead in the water. And I would like to see the administration start to think about how to let that group back on campus. It doesn't include me, but I do worry about people whose careers could be much disproportionately harmed by being trapped at home. And a small group on campus, I would think, could be allowable.
Good point.
Risa?
Thanks. Yeah, I'm also reading the chat, and it would be great to hear from some of the people who are writing on the chat group. I have some, this is obviously a really hard time, and I have some real concerns about, how the disconnectedness that we're all experiencing is affecting the decision making. I mean, we always have a difficult time having shared governance be a really robust process. And I appreciate what Charlie and Nima are doing in terms of keeping people involved as much as possible and you're being involved. But I really am very concerned with the sort of top-down approach that comes with crises, understanding that things happen to are complicated and it's hard to do that. And I would just love it if there's some way we could look now to between now and the fall and beyond to say, what can we put in place that actually addresses the way in which shared governance can be made as robust as possible? And one of the issues that I raised in an earlier discussion we had last week, sort of the open faculty discussion, was a concern I have that online classes will be promoted in a way from the administration that really pressures faculty to do it more without really having a shared governance process involved in it. And I'm already seeing some of that, in messages from deans, where it's viewed online work that we're doing as an opportunity to use it more in the future. So this is central to what we do as faculty. This is educational policy. That's just one of the examples.
I think the pandemic has forced a rethink of everything. And I think we often take for granted the value of residential, the residential experience, in-person teaching. Now we have, we're revisiting that, which is sort of healthy. And I think we have to, I was at some presentation where someone said, don't waste a crisis. A crisis does push you into thinking about things you took for granted and how we do things. I should say though, that major decisions are going to be made in the summer. So there's actually a practical issue here, which is when the summer comes, do we have Senate meetings? I mean, I'll just state it in that kind of form. How do we do things in the summer when people often are swept away with their own research? Anyway, more questions, Jill.
I apologize. I believe I lowered someone's hand before they had a chance to speak. I don't know who that was. Barstow is next. And just to make everyone aware, there's a considerable amount of chat and comments on chat.
Gosh, Ken and Risa, I really want to thank you for your comments regarding sort of junior researchers. I'm really appreciative, as an assistant professor, I'm really appreciative of sort of the possibility of extending the tenure clock. I'm not so worried about myself, but I am worried about a generation of postdocs and grad students. If you think about it, the postdoc is probably the most vulnerable time of anybody's career. It's, the shortest time span, and it's the most dependent upon sort of short-term grants. And I feel that this has the potential to derail an awful lot of people. And I feel like we've somehow got to get some support to these people to ensure that, when they should be, right now, they should be collecting data, they should be, for papers. And we somehow need to extend their timeline. This isn't a problem that's unique to Cornell. It's something that's shared, across the country, probably across the world. I really hope that we can figure out some way to deal with it.
Thanks, Buzz.
There's no one else raised hands.
I actually want to just speak to a whole set of comments that various people have raised, Tracy, Risa, many others, about this whole business of going online, right? We went online in very, very quickly. Somebody called it triage education. And we did so without necessarily, we tried very hard. We got a lot of support. We're happy about that. But it raises a lot of questions. It raises questions about, what does a long-term strategy mean? Can all courses do this? And how often are we going to keep doing this if the pandemic comes back a second time? I mean, there are many, many questions around it. and I think concerns. What does it mean to have signed on to be a faculty member at Cornell? We didn't sign on to be online educators, or did we? And so on and so forth. So one of the ideas Charlie and I had was to leave a larger sort of block for a discussion of exactly this, both its longer term implications and, you know, sort of this use of the ways in which we've done it now and how we feel supported or not as faculty in this sort of, you know, in the process that we're undergoing right now. So if it's okay with you, in a subsequent sort of faculty senate meeting, we leave a period of time to discuss this, because we do think it's important. And you know, I think many, not just we, but I think many of you feel it's really important and gets to the core of our mission. So your concerns around online education, just keeps collecting those. We'll set something up on the website to collect that information and then have a longer, more in-depth conversation around that.
Thanks, Neva.
Does Buzz Barr still want to speak again?
Thanks, Jill. If it's okay, if I can speak again.
Yeah, sure.
This is Buzz Barstow from Biological and Environmental Engineering. Charlie, I just wanted to like follow up on your point about like not wasting a crisis. I've actually really enjoyed, online teaching, actually. And I think we should, you know, say a big thank you to sort of everybody in CIT for, if you think about it, they've provided us with these amazing tools for doing online teaching that, you know, have really been tested over the past couple of weeks, and I think have really proven themselves. In earlier faculty senates, we've raised this question with President Pollack, like, what are we going to do about the sort of exploding cost of higher ed? And we haven't really gotten a satisfactory answer. You know, that's not to fault her, right? I don't think anybody has come up with one yet. But maybe this gives us an opportunity to think about how do we solve that problem. And I think, like you said, I don't think we should waste a crisis. And I hope just by bringing this up, you know, inspires us, you know, in the next coming months to really think about this.
Good point, Buzz.
Ken Berman.
I simply wanted to say that I think the communication quality has been quite high, and that these opportunities have been excellent. And as we move forward, and eventually when we start to talk about returning to the campus, even if it does involve a Senate meeting in the summer, many of us are going to have concerns about our own safety. We're not young people, and so a lot of us are solidly in the demographic that has to be concerned. And I think that engaging this way and airing concerns is a very healthy and positive part of the, you know, faculty governance. And I'd like to see that continue.
Yeah, it can be done in a very low overhead, non-intrusive, hey, drop in if you have time kind of thing. So I think we could pull that off. And as I said, you know, major, major decisions are going to be made June, July, and so on, and we'll be paying attention all along the way, and should articulate our thoughts as they develop. Anything else, Jill?
Risa has her hand up.
Yeah, sorry, Jill. So this is the governance issue again. All right. I mean, oftentimes the term of not wasting a crisis is used as a critique of people at the top of an organization imposing things on people on the bottom. And so, you know, kind of turning it around that way, this is the moment. We're all home, right? We're not traveling this summer. This is the moment where a real structure of governance, not just a conversation, but a real structure of governance to place us into where we belong on educational policy, having discussions, having votes on resolutions, really dealing with this as a governance process, which is integrated with the decisions, as Charlie said, that will be made. And you said it in the passive voice, decisions will be made. Who's going to make them? The administration will be making decisions. We need to be acting proactively on issues that we know are being handled. So this is a real I'm advocating for us to take control and actively use governance when we're all here. We're not scattering for the summer.
Okay. Anything, we're at the 5 o'clock point here. I'm gonna go get a drink as soon as I push the end meeting button here. Anyone wanna sum it all up? Anyone wanna wax eloquent here for 30 seconds to, I really like, you know, we have
I beat you to the drink, Charlie. I beat you to the drink by an entire glass.
Okay, so let's not get carried away. Okay, so I guess that's the end of the meeting. Thank you very much. It was productive, and we'll be in touch. We'll send you a synopsis. We'll be in touch about the next meeting, and we can be flexible about when that is, and we can also think a little bit about the having discussions on specific issues that relate to the pandemic and its effect on the university and so on. Well, thank you very much. The meeting's over.
Thanks, Jill and Charlie.
Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jill.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Jill, does the chat get recorded?
Yes.
Good.
Jill, could you tell us where to get a recording of the meeting?
It will be posted on the website where the minutes usually are.
With the minutes, thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Do they get transcribed the same way they were before?
They will.
It's 5 o'clock, lady.
I'm out of here.
Okay, I'm going. I'll see you later. Bye. Oh, wait.
Oh.
All right, I'm going. See you later.
Bye.